The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to today's Football Weekly. I am Max Rushton. I would like to apologise. I'm sorry on behalf of The Guardian and the pod. I realise that my actions purely by being here have brought Guardian news media into disrepute. As @Stinger1904 wrote last night on Twitter, I'd rather listen to a wet fish slapping off a wall for 40 minutes than listen to you. But life goes on. I can confirm that Barry Glendening and I did shake hands prior to the pod, so hopefully that makes everything okay. Today, you will hopefully learn the following. One, are Liverpool really sorry? And are Man United sure they're sorry? Should the new England boss Harry Redknapp take Paul Scholes to the Euros? Is Roberto Mancini going to pick Carlos Tevez if he says he's sorry? And is Aaron Ramsey directly responsible for Whitney Houston's sad death? Plus, Sid is in Spain, Jonathan in Africa. We look ahead to the return of the Champions League. And of course, we will find out who the next Wolves boss is going to be. On the panel today, Sean Ingle is here. How are you, Sean?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. Do you have anything to apologise for on this day of apologies?
Probably to my wife. I bought her a really nice Valentine's Day present, but I don't think it's going to arrive in time.
Barry Glendening is here. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Thanks for tweeting that I'm an idiot about 5 minutes ago. I appreciate that.
I'd like to apologise for referring to you on Twitter last night as celebrity sexes, Max Rushton.
I'm afraid I don't have any more celebrity sexual exploits to update you on today.
That's an awful shame.
Yeah, it's a shame. Fernando Duarte is here. Your apology.
Good morning. I'd like to apologise to all Liverpool fans by not being a total blind supporter, by not treating the club like a cult, and for not thinking that we're victims of conspiracies all the time. I'm really, really sorry that people managed to think I'm pro and anti-Liverpool in the same week. Fact is, support them, do not follow them or pray to them.
All right, let's start properly. We have to start at Old Trafford, the non-handshake that was then super slow-moed on Match of the Day with Alan Hansen giving some tactical details of how Suarez moved his hand out of the way and then all the apologies yesterday. What did you make of it, Fernando? You seem passionate about this.
Yeah, the thing is, I seem to be a victim of a conspiracy of the stars. Every time there is an incident involving Luis Suarez, I'm in the pod right afterwards. But these appearances are agreed before. So, I mean, it wasn't on purpose. Thing is, I am of the opinion that the handshake shouldn't have happened at the first place. I mean, the handshake ceremony thing.
Sure.
If they did at QPR and Chelsea, that's a game that was waiting for this not to happen. Okay, of course, there was a chance for Liverpool to show some kind of restraint or some kind of constraint, for Suarez to redeem himself, but at the same time, it was a disaster way to happen. What if Evra didn't shake his hand, or if Ferdinand decided to take, you know, actions into his hands? The thing is, the situation is starting to get a bit ridiculous. People are going to get hurt. Supporters are going to start, like, punching each other out if this thing escalates, because it's getting a bit too silly. And let me also add, Sir Alex shouldn't have said too much. And then why? Why saying, oh, you should never play for Liverpool again, this club, that club? Do we need a massive hate figure in Merseyside stirring things up as much as he's had the right to be offended by Suarez's behaviour, which, by the way, was despicable. And I'm glad the club's done something about it finally.
Barry?
While the apology is welcome, the general consensus seems to be they were only issued because the club was criticised by the New York Times and some paper in Boston, the name of which escapes me, and the American owners clunked heads and said, "Ye better apologise." And I would imagine quite possibly threatened them, both Kenny Dalglish and Luis Suarez, with their jobs if they didn't apologise. I agree with Fernando that handshakes before a game are ridiculous. There's no need for them, especially when you've players shaking hands and then going out kicking lumps out of each other or diving and cheating, trying to get each other sent off. It's pretty much an empty gesture, but, you know, it's a start. And it made a lot of Liverpool fans, particularly paranoid ones, look really silly because they were coming up with these conspiracy theories that and trying to provide photographic proof that it was Evra's fault there was no handshake, so that there's not much of a peep out of them anymore. And of course, it also led to the main handshake snub of the weekend, which is when the Aston Villa mascot refused to shake hands with his opposite number before the Manchester City game.
If you YouTube that, it is actually brilliant, isn't it? I mean, how these guys must be 8 years old. And it's not that he's not shaking hands with everybody. He shakes hands with the player before and the player after, or the linesman, and he purposefully ignores his 8-year-old friend.
So that's the example they're setting, isn't
it? Won't someone think of the children, please?
Is this done now? And what happens to Suarez and Dalglish?
Well, I think it's done until perhaps when they play each other again next season, hopefully. I don't think anything will happen in the short term to Suarez or to Dalglish, but maybe coming into the season, depends how Liverpool do. If Liverpool don't end up winning anything, and Suarez gets involved in more incidents, then you may well see both of them being escorted out of Anfield. The trouble is, Dalglish has such a power over the whole operation. I think he's a wonderful player. Was a fantastic manager the first time around, but he's taken so many wrong decisions in the last couple of months over this thing, and he perhaps needed someone in authority at Liverpool to have just been able to say to him, "Put yourself together, man. This is just you're going down a really stupid, silly hole." It's a shame because what happened on Saturday is distracted actually from a pretty decent Manchester United performance. I'm still not completely convinced by them when I watched them, but I thought on Saturday they dominated the game and deservedly won.
And Wayne Rooney seems to be waking up, which is very interesting for England prospects in the Euros, even though he's not going to be there for the two first matches. Interesting to see he seems to...
Well, more for United's prospects to win the league. I mean, he didn't really show until sort of March last year that he had a great last 3 months of the season.
And is that the first game as well that I thought Paul Scholes was outstanding that game?
No, absolutely. He was brilliant. Whether he should go to the Euros is, I think maybe taking things two or three stages too far at the moment. But he was certainly excellent on Saturday.
Just an example to a lot of players. I mean, not saying that, in terms of whoever he does, whatever he talks about, but as a player, I mean, to be still firing his cylinders at that kind of age, especially after retiring, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'm amazed he's kept his fitness. Where, what was he doing when he retired? I don't know how many months it was that he wasn't playing. But surely the first thing you do after retiring from playing football for that long is just start eating and drinking a whole lot.
Just look at John Barnes, for example.
Scholes, I don't think, is a big boozer particularly. He seems to be very much a family man. His idea of a fun day out is, just playing with his kids. And he was working with Manchester United, so presumably keeping fit there, helping out in his role as whatever his coaching role was.
And Harry Redknapp says that if he got the England job, which he probably will, then he would like to take Scholes to the Euros. Sean, you're not so sure, Barry?
If he's good enough and he's happy to go, why not bring him? He's an asset to any team. But one other interesting aspect, sorry to go back to the Suarez thing again, but the Man United fanzine Red Issue had... all their copies were confiscated by Greater Manchester Police because they had a pullout in it of a Klan mask with Suarez's innocent, not a particularly funny joke, and you could be argued offensive, but the police confiscated all the copies because they were worried it might incite a riot, which seemed rather heavy-handed, even by the standards of police.
Presumably, these apologies now mean this is done and we can forget about it.
Well, not necessarily. Liverpool still haven't actually apologised for the original incident, I mean, it's tedious beyond belief. And if the apologies issued now help in some way to put this to bed and so we can stop waffling on about it, that'd be great.
Let's stop waffling on about it now and talk about the club Harry Redknapp is managing right now, Spurs. An amazing week for them, and they were sensational against Newcastle. And it's not easy to score four against Newcastle in 35 minutes. If you look at how many goals Newcastle conceded this season.
It does help, though, when you haven't got, Tioti or Kabay in the centre. It makes things a little easier, but I agree with you. They were sensational, played ever so well. I'd love to see them win the league. I don't think they quite will, but they have played superb football this season.
I'm pretty much surprised, and I'm happy to see Newcastle punching above their weight. But the thing about this game is that it didn't come to me as a massive surprise they were going to get thumped by a better side, because their victories against Blackburn and Bolton, if I'm not wrong, were pretty much lucky ones. They were really, really lucky against Blackburn, and all of a sudden, some people got surprised with perhaps the elasticity of the score, as we say in Portuguese, was surprised. But Tottenham are a much better side, and they should have won that game.
And how much of a genius is Harry? I mean, he gets Lewis Saha. I mean, it's one game, but Saha looked like a different player, didn't he?
Yeah, but then you could look at, I agree with you, he's a very good man, motivator, but what about Stephen Pienaar? Came to Spurs, played ever so well, leave Spurs, and suddenly, having been terrible.
True, but with more...
Darren Bent as well, treated shabbily by
Harry. Okay, but look at
how... Aurelio Gomez.
Okay, Adebayor, right?
This is going to turn it, apart from education, the aqueducts, well, what is
But look at Adebayor. Adebayor's never run the channels like he does for Tottenham. Has he?
I think people forget how good Adebayor was in his first season and a half at Arsenal. And also, he played very well for Real Madrid last season. So, and he's been a little bit dodgy recently. It was his best game for a while. I think at the moment, because Harry's doing so well, we seem to attribute everything Spurs does as, you know, as a part of his mystical grand plan. It wasn't that long ago that Redknapp was thinking about selling Bale, not to Inter Milan for 40 million, but, you know, to whoever would have him, because he wasn't convinced that he was quite good enough. So I'm not saying Redknapp isn't a very good manager. He is. But I think we're perhaps going a little bit too far at the moment.
Zaha said after the game, interestingly, that it's the fastest pace he's ever had to play football at, which, you know, might Spurs really do go straight out of the traps and tear into teams, which, you know, is always going to stand.
But surely, you know, Spurs will finish third, if not better. Then Harry will go into England, win the Euros, come back, win the league for Spurs, and you know, everyone will be happy if you're a Spurs fan. Which I kind of
and you seem to be one of them, because
my dad's a big Spurs fan. So he talks about Jimmy Greaves since I've been, you know, three.
But do I think England are going to win the Euros? It's too early for that. But no. You know, if you go through for the first round, I'll be surprised with the amount of very small quality football you've been playing recently. But then again, it's another story about Spurs. Yes, they should be there, third place. If they don't finish in the top three, it would be a disappointing season. However, let me also say something about Zaha. Mm-hmm. I reckon it says a lot about David Moyes' managerial skills as well, the fact that he was dead and buried at Everton. The systems there are not basically striker-friendly, are they?
We can talk about Everton. Now, you mentioned Stephen Pienaar. He did play brilliantly against Chelsea, didn't he?
He did, and Everton was superb. I thought Dennis Strakoalesi, you know, seemed to play very well, if I pronounced that
he's
right.
He's a brute, isn't he?
He is. But Chelsea, again, I mean, Felix Boas is clearly under a lot of pressure. He's going to have another visit from Abramovich and his goon squad soon. I feel for Felix Boas. I think he is clearly a very good coach. What he did with Porto last season was superb. But the way he likes to play, you know, very fast pressing game, you know, very quick football, it's quite hard to do with, you know, some of Chelsea's old boys, and the dressing room unrest that's been around for a while is only growing.
And he's missing some commanding centre back, and Luiz is not the guy to lead his defence, and then he throws in Cahill at that game, you know, out of the blue, and they have to play together for the first time, and we all saw how lost they were. I know it's an old game, but that was the Chelsea game I saw, like the 90 minutes, and they've got big problems, and I totally agree with you in regards to how he wants to play. It's fantastic to think, okay, I'm going to do a 4-3-3. If you haven't got the pieces, how the hell are you going to translate your thoughts into matter?
Are you surprised that Cahill hasn't come straight into the starting lineup, apart from that one game? And he didn't play against Norwich, which would have been a more sensible game to play in, wouldn't it? Then he's played against Man United. Now he doesn't play against Everton. Luiz plays centre-back. And everyone seems to think Luiz is a really good footballer, but we're not really sure where he's meant to play.
Yeah, it's a fair comment. I was surprised Cahill didn't play yesterday. There were more crisis talks at Chelsea's training ground on Sunday. The players were supposed to have the day off, but they were summoned by Abramovich.
And do we know, is Abramovich, is he's sitting watching training? What's he doing? He keeps coming in. Because I imagine if I was doing any job, if I was doing Soccer M and the head of Sky Sports was sat there in the audience, I'd be, you know, even more of a lemon than I normally am, to be brutally honest.
And what if the head of Sky was sitting watching and surrounded by goons with bulges in their breast pockets of their jackets?
The head of Sky Sports is sitting.
Increase the pressure on you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you've sat at Sky, I've got a box at Chelsea, and occasionally I go, and next door is Abramovich's box, and he is surrounded by these incredible heavies who, when Chelsea aren't doing well, scream in like the loudest Russian. I don't know if they're trying to look like they really care to Roman, but it is actually more entertaining normally than the game, and equally terrifying.
You've got a great job. I would love to see Abramovich goons, you know, pulling some toenails and something like that. Now, in regards to your boss being around, wasn't Abramovich once trying to give, what's his name, Michael Essien's instructions in the dressing room? There's a famous story that he was trying to teach Michael Essien how to position himself and how to distribute the ball.
Yeah,
oh, that's brilliant.
That's a tough gig, man. And I think Villas-Boas said yesterday, or says in the papers today, that if he doesn't get the Champions League spot, he's out. I pretty much tend to agree with him.
Right, we've got 30 seconds in part one to talk about the City game, because it wasn't very interesting. Barry?
Well, the talk at the moment is that Carlos Tevez will be back tomorrow being Tuesday, and that the City players are happy to have them back in the team because they need someone, they need him up front.
Mancini intimated if he says sorry, because we're all saying sorry, then he'll be okay.
It's a good time for him to come back because City have a Europa League game on Thursday, then they don't play in the FA Cup, and then they have Blackburn and Bolton at home before their schedule gets an awful lot tougher. So he has got time to, if he is to be embedded back in the team and to sort of rediscover his form.
If he learned anything, and if he's not as thick as I think he is, I think he will say sorry because it's ridiculous. He's going to have to do some kind of contrition to actually get back into the side. And I think his advisors must have told him something like, let's lay low because we didn't manage to get you out.
I was in Brazil last week and there was lots of talk about Corinthians being back for him. What's possible is that, Fernando?
Apparently the new guy who took over, the new president said, I forgot his name, sorry, but the new president said, well, he cooled off the idea a bit because it is a massive financial commitment for Corinthians. I know they have the money, but we're talking about a lot of wages as well. And remember when Tevez won the league with Corinthians, it was a long, long time ago, and the team was pretty good. This Corinthians team is what they call like a working man's team. They have a lot of guys who are not famous, too famous as well, because they got former Sporting
hard-working players like
piano carriers of the same Portuguese, or water carriers, as they say here. So I don't know if he would fit there. But I still think the problem is a financial commitment. It costs a lot, and he's a loose cannon. Corinthians wants to win the Libertadores, and it's a massive chance for them now.
Don't talk too much about Brazil, because otherwise we won't have a part three.
Okay, you can cut it off if you want.
No, we won't cut it off. We'll keep it, because it was interesting. But we'll move straight on to part two, well, in a second. That was part one. In part two, we will talk to Sid in Spain. We'll look ahead to the Champions League games this week, and we will decide who is getting relegated from the Premier League. Welcome to part two of Football Weekly. In the break between part one and part two, which was very short, the only thing we learnt is that Fernando gets sweaty ears during the podcast. How are they? Are they all right now?
They're fine. Just too much, much cushion.
Yeah, they're big headphones.
Yeah.
We'll try and get you some smaller ones the next time you're here. Right, so while we were preparing for the pod, Mick McCarthy, who was sorry for the first time yesterday after a defeat, must have been really, really sorry. Well, he got sacked about an hour ago, depending on when you're listening. Surprised?
I'm not surprised. I have a lot of time for Mick McCarthy. He's a gent and he's straight talker and there isn't much bull about him, And he's a good manager, but the fans at Molineux had turned on him. The results weren't good enough. And yesterday, getting humiliated at home by a not particularly good West Brom side was pretty much always going to be the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think Mick will be all right. He'll get another job. He's kind of like some players, say Michael Chopper would be an example that seemed to be very good at championship level, but just not quite good enough.
Is it the Neil Warnock syndrome over again?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, McCarthy has the lowest win percentage rate of any manager who's managed for more than 100 Premier League games. It's down around like 19% or something. Now, it's probably unfair to throw that in because a lot of those games would have been in charge of an absolutely awful Sunderland team that just wasn't well equipped enough to be in the Premier League and didn't have any money to strengthen their squad.
But if you're going to fire someone, shouldn't you fire them before the window?
Well, I think you fire someone at this stage if you think someone you can bring in is going to be better than McCarthy. And the current sort of favourites are Steve Bruce, Kerbyshire, who may well be better, but he's never really managed north of the M25. And then the Warnocks of this world. So there isn't anyone out there that's going to noticeably improve Wars. Secondly, I don't think they'd have had someone lined up. I mean, clearly when Sunderland got rid of Steve Bruce, they had a couple of irons in the fire already, so they're able to make that transition.
They played for the gallery in this one, didn't they?
I think so.
They wanted to offer McCarthy as a sacrifice to the supporters. See, we're doing this for you.
Alan Kirbishley's brother is the tour manager for Led Zeppelin. Robert Plant is a big Wolves fan, so Kirbishley is a shoo-in.
I'd be surprised. The other thing to point out is that on the 13th of February last year, Wolves were bottom of the league and 3 points off safety. They stayed up. At the moment, their only goal difference is putting them in the relegation zone. So I still think McCarthy had every chance of keeping them up.
Actually, they're 17th at the moment, aren't they? Who else is around? Capello? John Beck?
Well, Capello was being linked with the Inter job, but Inter fans over the weekend were very vocal in their chants that they don't want him. And apparently Capello is also in talks with that Dagestan club, Anzi...
He needs the money, doesn't he?
So,
there's this random place that pay people a trillion zillion pounds.
Yeah, so I mean...
You commute from Moscow every day, 4 hours on a plane.
How's Capello's Russian, or does that not matter?
I don't think it matters. His English wasn't great. But, I mean, Steve Bruce is already the favourite to replace McCarthy, which I just find extraordinary, because for the last year of his reign in Sunderland, he was absolutely atrocious, and his efforts have been shown up to be even worse than we thought by the success O'Neill has made of the club.
I predicted them to be the surprise package of the Premier League, which they are, but only because of O'Neill. Okay, right, well, that's enough of the Premier League, but for now we'll talk to Sid in Spain. How are you, Sid?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Another hat-trick for Cristiano Ronaldo at the weekend. Barcelona lost. Real have a 10-point lead. That's La Liga done and done, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's even the Catalan media are saying the same thing. Some of Barcelona players, if you read between the lines, seem very clearly to be more or less giving up. They're saying that, we'll keep fighting to the end. But I think they know that it's beyond them. Everybody today is talking about the Champions League. It's all concentrate on the league thing. When you get knocked out of the cup, or when you get knocked out of the cup, you start. When you get knocked out of the league, you start concentrating on the cup. It's just too much, I think, for Barcelona to overhaul now. Real Madrid could lose three times and still win the league, even if Barcelona won every single game. And I think Real Madrid know that they're not going to lose three times. They're not going to drop that many points. You look at their record this year, it's 19 wins in 21 games, I think. The difference between Real Madrid now at this stage of the season this year and Real Madrid at this stage of the season last year is actually only 2 points difference. It's Barcelona that have really changed. 48 points they've got this stage now. It was 61 at this point last season.
You talk about some of the problems that Barcelona have had. I mean, they're still quite strong favourites for the Champions League, but would you put Real Madrid up there as having an equal chance given the way they're playing recently?
I don't see any reason why not. Now, of course, what Barcelona, I think, have shown, and there's been a lot of talk in Spain about the difficulties of motivation when you've got a team that's won the league 3 years in a row, when you've got a team that has won virtually everything, of course, two World Club Championships, a couple of Champions Leagues, the Copa del Rey as well. They're now in the final of the Copa del Rey. They've had eight games this month because of the Copa del Rey, which I think also has played a part in all this. And there's no doubt that some of the players are genuinely tired. But there's a motivational problem, which is that the league title isn't an immediate target, and it's difficult to motivate toward the target that's in the distance. And that's why I think Barcelona have dropped points, perhaps in games where you wouldn't expect them to drop points, and yet they've still been able to beat Madrid when every time they face them, they've been able to lift themselves and play that game, because when they get it right, of course, they're still a brilliant side. In the Champions League, you could argue, okay, they're going to continue to get it right because that motivation is there, because the prize is dangled in front of you every two games rather than, once every 38 games or whatever it is in the league. But I do think there are some problems. I think one of the reasons they lost this weekend, for example, was because the players were partly left out looking towards the Champions League. And I think there's a certain degree of vulnerability for Barcelona. And yeah, right now, the way they're playing, you'd say that Madrid are every bit as much of a favourite as Barcelona are.
Sid, Fernando here. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for asking. Thing is, they can still win five trophies this season. I reckon they put the bar so high in the last few seasons that we basically disappointed that they're not perfect all the time. It can still be a fantastic season for them, even though the league's pretty much buried under the carpet, isn't it?
Yeah, it can still be an absolutely enormous season for them, and I think as well the season, as happened last year, and as I think always happens to some extent in Spain, the season will be defined by the Champions League slightly more than by the domestic league. So, for example, if Barcelona were to win the Champions League, then losing the league title wouldn't be such a big deal. They would still come out of the season, I think, as feeling like they were the winners. In particular, of course, if on route to winning the Champions League, they were to knock out or even to play Real Madrid in the final and beat them. And I think there is a slight touch of Real Madrid's league title. I think some fans, and obviously some fans would disagree with this, and I've spoken to a lot of them who would say, no, winning the league really, really matters no matter how it happens. But I think if Barcelona were to win the Champions League and were to knock out Real Madrid en route, if Barcelona were to then beat Real Madrid again in the league, let's say for argument's sake this run extends, that would make it, 13 games maybe of Barcelona not losing to Real Madrid, and Madrid win the league, then it would I say not losing to Madrid, of course they lost a couple of their A final, then it might feel a little bit watered down, a league title. But right now, I don't think any Madrid fan sees it like that. At the end of the season, if Barca win the Champions League, they might.
Interesting. Sid, thank you very much for your time. We'll speak to you on Thursday. And I might ask you some questions on Thursday, but you guys were all really good, so that's good. Getting paid for doing nothing, which is similar to Saturdays. Also in the Champions League, Arsenal play Milan. Tough game. Good pronunciation, that, wasn't it, Sean? Thanks. I'm learning. Is that a tough game for Arsenal? Milan top of Serie A?
Yeah, although I saw them on Saturday and they were awful. They managed to win. I mean,
you've seen Arsenal lately as well, haven't you?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, Arsenal have got a huge next few games. Obviously, they play Milan. Then they've got Sunderland in the Cup. Then they've got Spurs, Liverpool, Newcastle, Everton in the league. I haven't been completely convinced by Arsenal at all this season, even though when they went through a good run. But I would still give them the edge over Milan over two legs.
Well, Milan have gone out at this stage of the competition in their last three Champions Leagues, always to English opposition, so you know, recent history is against them. And the only reason Arsenal beat Sunderland on Saturday was because that was actually my fault. Because when Sunderland went to goal up, I went on Twitter and said, "Can anyone stop this Macam juggernaut?" At which point,
certainly Mertesacker certainly could he?
And at which point, Jonathan Wilson tweeted from Africa telling me to stop tweaking fate by the nose, and Arsenal promptly scored two goals. So that's another thing I'd like to apologise for. But
they showed some mettle at least, Arsenal. I think Arsenal at the start of the season probably wouldn't have come back and won that game.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's the fair point. But they've put metal in, but they've lost the touch of silk, haven't they?
That's so beautiful.
So poetic.
Wow.
Lost for words. Speaking of people's fault, Aaron Ramsey scored at the weekend, prompting The Sun to write an article very tenuously linking his goal scoring with the deaths of various people in the public eye. He scored on Saturday, and obviously Whitney Houston sadly passed away. This all started apparently in May when he scored against Man United, and the following day, Arsenal fan Osama bin Laden was killed. In October, he scored against Spurs. Fernando, don't look so confused. He scored against Spurs 3 days before Steve Jobs sadly died, and in the same month, he scored in the Champions League the day before Colonel Gaddafi was dragged out of that pipe and killed. So The Sun linking Aaron Ramsey to the death of many people.
That is genius journalism, seriously. That is why we actually, you know, get into this profession, to find stories like that. Well done.
You speak of genius journalism. Producer Ben spent this morning very constructively. This is my fifth appearance, February the 13th. On this day in history, Catherine Howard was executed for adultery, the fifth wife of King Henry VIII. On February the 21st, which was the first time I ever did it, same day as Malcolm X was assassinated.
You're a racist.
That was in 1965.
A racist and a bounder.
Okay. February the 24th, a slow death day. Certainly the first nylon bristle toothbrush was made. September the 19th, 1995, was declared International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And September the 22nd, 1985, Cagney and Lacey won the Emmy for Best TV Show. So they're the things that I have somehow...
Is that the worst bit of research producer Ben has ever done? I mean, it's so spurious.
I agree. But it may make the pod, we don't know. We'll find out when we listen back.
You know why pirates are called pirates, right?
Oh, tell us.
Because they are...
Welcome to part three of Football Weekly, and we are going to start in Brazil. Fernando, what is going on with Adriano? Apparently he's been forced into house arrest or hotel arrest by Corinthians to make sure he loses weight. Is this correct?
Yes, because otherwise he'd just go on massive benders. And you know what happens when Adriano gets out? He's even worse than, the bloke, Ramsey. Because whenever Adriano is around, trouble seems to follow him. And it's like people being shot. The boy is always in some kind of like a bizarre situation. And obviously he's not a very athletic guy. He loves a bit of booze.
So hang on, they're keeping him where? In a hotel?
Yeah, they're telling him to lie low. That's what I understand from that. And the hotel arrest is that in Brazil you have something called what they call concentration, which is a horrendous thing to translate because it sounds like something else. But players, they have to be in a hotel with the team before, I think, 2 days before a match sometimes. It's not like in Europe where it's a bit more flexible. Okay. They have to concentrate in a hotel. So I think Adriano's been kept in some kind of house arrest.
But is there somebody, I mean, because hotels have food, don't they?
And
minibars and alcohol. I mean, well, we do need to keep him. Is there somebody watching him?
I think that they're kind of like using the press to control him a bit. It's like the 15th chance he's getting to actually get into shape. And again, Corinthians needs him. Corinthians need them for the Libertadores. It's a massive tournament, and they want to win it. And if Adriano gets 50% of his shape, of his usual shape, he can actually be very, very, very important.
Sean, you've been in Brazil?
Yeah, I have. I was in Brazil last week. I went to see Palmeiras play. Saw big Phil Scolari walking up and down the touchline, and this guy called Marcos Assunção, who is a big rotund figure, doesn't really move much, but takes a fantastic free kick and corner, and he set up a goal and scored one as well.
He's sort of like the Sabutio corner kicker. You know, the one that was like twice the size of all the other players that could only bend backwards and forwards.
You said earlier he was like Andy Hinchcliffe.
But the greatest corner taker of all time. I stand by that.
I'm saying Gylfi Sigurdsson is a better corner taker than Andy Hinchcliffe.
But Hinchcliffe had Ferguson.
Tell
the
story about Brazil, because the Adriano thing is like a soap opera. You know, it's like Hollyoaks. There's an earthquake here, and then everybody gets married the next week. But anyway, there's a Pará state football game in which a brawl ended up with a player hitting another one with an iron bar. Now that's a brawl I'd love to see in the Premiership one of these days. You know.
So, hang on, where did he get the bar? It's not like wrestling where a chair is conveniently placed.
There was a fight on the pitch, and a substitute picked up an iron bar, pitch side. It must be something used to remove advertising board or whatever, and hit one of his opponents with that. Obviously, the guy was arrested on the spot. He left.
Did he get a yellow or red card?
No, he was a substitute. He was sent off, obviously, and sent to the to a police station in a kind of like.
Did his manager come out and say it was all the fault of Sky Sports News?
No, I don't think so. The video is funny though. The bloke had like two ribs broken, but
it's never funny unless ribs are broken.
No, it looks like a bad, a bad movie. One of those bad like Jim Zucker Abraham's movie. The guy walks in and whacks the other one of that iron bar. It's like,
and are they going to shake hands? Where are we at with that? Or he's in prison?
I don't know if the guy can raise his arm now because he's been kind of like.
Have you ever broken your ribs?
Yes, I have.
Painful, isn't it?
Yeah, but playing rugby when I was in school.
Just when you really notice how often you inhale, which is half the time, basically, but every time you do it, it's a killer. Right, let's cross to Gabon. Zambia won the African Cup of Nations on penalties. Jonathan Wilson was at the final in Libreville. How was it, Jonathan?
Fantastic. I think the most emotional sporting event I've ever covered. And what was striking was that the local fans, who had actually turned out and filled the stadium, the Gabonese fans really got behind Zambia. Now, that's surprising because relations between the two countries have been really bad since the air crash. But even at the time, in the immediate aftermath, there were demonstrations in the street in Libreville, people complaining that the mortuary facilities were being used for Zambians rather than local people. There was then a whole toing and froing over the investigations to who should pay for it. There was a feeling on the Zambian side that the Gabonese were being unhelpful, that they were trying to hide things, that possibly the safety checks hadn't been good enough. There were even rumours that the Gabonese army had shot the plane down by mistake. So, I mean, their diplomatic relations were abysmal, and you know, weirdly so, given how the two countries really have nothing to do with each other. And so to see the home fans, you know, just being won over by the underdog story, by the great triumph of the human spirit of Zambia was hugely emotional on a generally emotional night.
Aside, putting the emotion aside, were they the worthy winners footballing-wise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they clearly aren't, Ivory Coast players are clearly better players, but this tournament, Ivory Coast have been very, very cautious. They should have won in 2006. Didier Drogba missed a sitter tournament some time and missed his penalty in the shootout against Egypt. They went into the next tournament in Ghana as favourites. They went to the tournament after that in Angola as favourites. And both of those tournaments, they seemed to be going along fine, seemed to be going along very smoothly, and suddenly the wheels fell off and they lost. This tournament, they've really tried to minimise their risk. It's been absolutely safety first, waiting for mistakes, waiting for set plays. And I think that actually, paradoxically, then became a very risky strategy because there was no second prize. You either won the tournament and Francois Zahiri, the coach, was praised for his pragmatism and for instilling that discipline, or he's just a boring coach who lost. And unfortunately, he's just a boring coach who lost.
Compared to Irv Renard, the former Cambridge United legend who managed to... he really helped take us from League Two down to the Conference in 2004. But he's gone on to better things with Zambia, so I'm pleased for him.
Yeah, he's been a great figure in this tournament. He's a very engaging man. He sort of gets the balance right between kind of quite being quite cocky and quite arrogant, but it's undercut by self-irony. He knows what he's doing. And what was fascinating last night was he revealed that he actually expected them to get to the final because he wears these lucky white shirts. So Zambia have never lost a Cup of Nations game when he's worn white. So the only game they've actually lost, if you don't count the penalty shootout defeat to Nigeria 2 years ago, was when they played Cameroon and he wore a blue shirt. So he made sure he bought white shirts this time, but he only brought three. He brought one for the group stage, one for the quarterfinal and semifinal, and then an extra smart for one for last night for the final. So he packed expecting to be in the final, which suggests his confidence and his... I think that sort of bubbliness of personality has helped carry them through.
Jonathan, sorry, I have to ask. Curiosity's got the better of me. Is there a budgie on your shoulder?
No, but I mean, I'm standing in the garden of the house where I'm staying, and there are birds, and actually there's a large lizard looking at me from the steps at the minute. But anyway, going back to Hervé Renard, you saw the two sides of him last night. That midway through the first half, he absolutely bollocked Davies and Kouser, the right back, for getting too far forward. I mean, he actually punched him, as he came over to take a swell, absolutely smacked him in the chest. And David Nkausa sort of put his arm around him and told him to calm down. And he explained afterwards that he'd been specifically telling David Nkausa, don't get too high at the pitch because Jovinho can do for pace in the same way he did Marley for pace. So you saw that sort of aggression and the toughness that he's brought. And, he sent home Clifford Malenga early in the tournament for breaking a curfew, which I think suggests that ruthlessness, the fact that he desperately wants discipline there. But also then at the end, the fact he picked up Joseph Mazongo, who'd come off with an injury after 12 minutes, picked him up and physically carried him onto the pitch to join the celebrations, I think shows, the warmer side of him. So I think, again, he's got that balance right between being very firm and very tough, but also very, very, very warm towards his players. And their relationship is clearly fantastically good.
I presume you've watched a lot of this. Any of the African sides, do you think you're going to go on to the World Cup in a couple of years and make an impact?
Well, again, you look at Ivory Coast and you think they should do something eventually. And the last two World Cups, of course, they've had very, very tough draws. You'd look at them. I mean, Zambia are interesting. They've actually got a really tough draw in the World Cup. Their qualifying group has them with Ghana, Sudan. Sudan were pretty impressive in the summer, much more impressive than I was expecting them to be. And I think if they'd had a bit more self-belief, they might have even gone further in the quarterfinal. But they had a tendency to panic at the company they were keeping and then make mistakes. But when they forgot themselves and played, they were quite good. I mean, Lesotho are the other team in the group, so okay, they're not really going to be relevant. But Sudan are difficult, and Ghana are obviously hugely difficult with only one of those four to go through to the playoffs. So for Zambia to go through, I think it'd be difficult. You'd expect Ghana, I think, to improve. I mean, you'd worry slightly about sort of an arrogance they showed in this tournament. I think they really expected to just walk past Zambia in the semi-final and didn't. Yeah, I think Ivory Coast and Zambia, probably Ghana. And then, of course, you've got the teams who didn't qualify. What are Nigeria going to do? What are Cameroon going to do? Is failing to qualify going to give them the kick of the arse they need to put their house in order and actually put in a proper structure and a proper coach?
Jono, it also says a lot about this golden generation, this Ivorian golden generation. The guys can't do it. It's unbelievable. Even when the whole draw is open for them to make a killing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a general thing with golden generations. So as soon as you call something a golden generation, it doesn't win. And the English golden generation didn't. Even the Hungarian golden generation lost in the final of the World Cup. The Bulgarian golden generation lost in the semi-finals of the World Cup, which, okay, great achievement for them. But then it hung around too long and Bulgaria declined rapidly towards the end of the 90s. Romania's golden generation the same. So the golden generation seems to be sort of a curse that's given to teams rather than a great blessing.
Are you safe to leave Gabon? You got the right papers, or are you stuck there forever?
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed. I'm going on to Douala tomorrow night, so I've got a week in Cameroon before I come back.
All right. Well, have a lovely time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, Jonathan Wilson. Out in Gabon, and if he can leave Gabon, he'll go to Cameroon, and if he leaves there, he'll presumably come back and be on the pod at any time. That's pretty much it. We've got a couple of... Barry, you looked like you wanted to say something.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think Wilson's going to Sri Lanka once he gets back to watch some cricket.
All right. Do you have any more news about Jonathan or either of you two?
You haven't told a single celebrity story or a home improvement story. Surely Trevor Nelson has helped you put up a shelf or something.
Well, do you know what? The house is pretty much done. Oh, you'd be interested to know. I'm trying to buy art.
Oh, God.
What's that face for, Sean?
A poster of
Samantha
a tennis
Fox.
Player
yeah, come
scratching
on.
Her backside. And
No, I'm trying to... There's an art
some
shop
dogs
just over
playing
the road.
Poo.
I've bought a picture of some woodpeckers
right
recently. And I like maps in quite a big way. And then the only showbiz news is that in a couple of weeks, for some unknown reason, Helen and I are Helen, who presents Soccer M as well, if you don't know what it is.
Hell's Bells.
We are both
your glamorous sidekick.
Yeah, we're both singing, making our West End debuts in Rock of Ages, right, alongside Justin Lee Collins and Shane Ward. Right,
oh, that's brilliant. Where are you going to sing?
I think we're doing "Don't Stop Believing" by Journey. although I'm practicing "Here I Go Again" on by Whitesnake on my guitar, just in case they let me do a solo. But for the show on Thursday, we're having singing lessons from Blue. Popular 90s boy band Blue are going to teach us how to sing.
They're not from the 90s, they're from the noughties.
Oh, are they?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I saw them win, like, or they present themselves at the National Television Awards, that ITV horrendous mumbo jumbo, a couple of years ago. I mean, they were shit. And they and they made themselves even more dunk over when they went to represent Britain in a Eurovision contest. I've never watched the thing, but on that night I watched it, said lose, lose, lose. And it was good because they were like 12 or something like that. But, you know,
I'm told.
Have you ever been at the National Television Awards?
do you know what? When it's on, I always wonder why I'm sitting in the Wilmington Arms having a Guinness. I haven't made the cut. I presume it's just a terrestrial TV. That's the only possible explanation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't tell me Tim Lovejoy's won it all.
Don't know.
No, unlikely. Anyway, there were a couple of tweets.
You never got me on a Genk bus, by the way.
I'm sorry about that.
You let me down.
Yeah, I did. We're kind of done now, aren't we? I mean, I'm enjoying this kind of slow end to this. Ben says that you can sing us out, given it's Valentine's Day.
Song? All right.
You've got a guitar? There must be one in here.
No, he's in G, man.
All right, you start, and I'll join in.
Now that I want to talk to you and
make you understand, all you have to do is close your eyes and just reach out your hand.
Go low.
And touch me. Hold me close. Don't ever let me go. More than words is all you have to do to make it real.
Did we go out of tune there?
Yeah, we did. You came to my voice.
Once Blue teach me and I come back, then I'll be great. Thanks very much. Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melinda.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
We're obviously all very sorry for what's just happened, especially the singing. On Thursday, producer Ben says the only name on the panel that is worth mentioning is James Horncastle, Italian expert. I'll be with him and two others who I will apologise to. We'll see you on Thursday. Cheers.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.